Under our kinds of electronic environment, the only work that a child in our world has to do is just to grow. Growing up is an enormous task when there is such a vast amount of information to process. It was Jacques Ellul, the French philosopher of technology, who pointed out that no child has ever worked so hard as the 20th century child. In all human history, no child ever worked so hard. Doing what? Data processing. The amount of work that our children have to do in just looking and being in their environments, fantastic. Exhausting. The old packaged goods, mass-produced, uniform, repeatable, are obviously disappearing under electronic impulse. You'll get a very good image of this in Xerox and its effect on the book. The printed book as a package is yielding rapidly to the Xerox tailor-made package for the special needs of a special customer. The tendency of electronics is to decentralize totally, not to centralize, and to move steadily toward the providing of custom-built satisfactions for the individual. The age of the mass-produced consumer item would seem to be on the skids.
The natural tendency is to use a new technology for the old job, and this is particularly true of our own new media, which have come upon us so suddenly. They're all new. It seems to be an attempt to find security by translating anything that is new into something that is familiar.
The natural tendency is to use any new technology for the old purposes. The current uses of television are to simulate the old-fashioned classroom. Not to exploit television, but to make it simulate something that was done earlier, before television. Naturally, therefore, there's a huge wastage of opportunity here. And I really don't have any strong feelings about this, because it's a situation that will tend to correct itself in time, but there's a lot of waste in the meanwhile. For centuries, the only kind of skill or grammar or literacy that was taught was that connected with the writing, reading and writing itself. All the other skills and technologies of the environment were accepted as merely environmental and taken for granted. Today, we have, because these things have stepped up in many of their developments, in many of their manifestations, we have to understand the language and grammars of many media. And this... It is rather fantastic, isn't it, when you think of the number of hours that people spend in front of film or television, for them to know nothing about the processes of making these things, or nothing about the means available for themselves to express themselves. So, by typing. But the McLaren world makes a tremendous break with ordinary film in this way, that by painting directly onto the film, you make the audience, as it were, the screen, instead of making the audience the camera eye. And so the child then, by drawing directly onto film, has a sense of mastery over the whole world. It's like a composer writing a melody. He makes a world. The composer making a melody doesn't try to make a world that corresponds to some other world. He just etches or makes with sound a world. McLaren, when he draws directly onto film, makes a world. He isn't photographing a situation which corresponds to some other situation. So this switch from matching to making is a drastic one in terms of the learning process. It switches altogether again from classified data, from mere matching knowledge, to a world of actual discovery and actual knowing of forms. I think you couldn't find a larger switchover in the whole history of education.
People don't study the media. They don't study the forms and their effects. They just study the inputs. The process of reading is a very hypnotic and soporific one. The ordinary commentator and reviewer always starts out from a point of view, and I don't.
Well, you have a point of view that you think it's a good thing for people to be aware of this process.
I think it takes an awful lot of hard work to find out what's going on, and you cannot find out what's going on by having a point of view. The man with a point of view is already detached, is already committed to non-exploration, non-involvement. He is merely there to insist upon the validity of, the consistency of his point of view, which is like having a vanishing point, a perspective, which belongs to Renaissance technology and culture. It does not belong to our time. You might, a man in a space capsule does not have a point of view. A man in such a situation has a multitude of rapidly changing points of view, and this is much more relevant. If you want to understand what's happening to our world, think about the space capsule man. The natural tendency is to use a new technology for the old job, and this is particularly true of our own new media, which have come upon us so suddenly. They're all new. It seems to be an attempt to find security by translating anything that is new into something that is familiar.
The human environment can be programmed as a teaching machine. It can become a form of total instruction. But we tend to still be back in the 19th century phase of classrooms, educational television, instruction rather than discovery, and so on. One of the things, by the way, that happens when you put an information environment around the whole planet is that the globe becomes a little round schoolhouse and becomes a teaching machine. And we go on talking about classrooms and programmed instruction in classrooms when the planet itself has become a little round schoolhouse, a programmed environment. That's just how far our present thinking is from what's actually happening. We're always way behind events. As somebody put it, I think it was someone out in the West Coast said, the future of the future is the present. But it's very hard to see the present. But if you have developed techniques for looking at the present, you can easily predict the future because it's already here. And so a prophet is simply a person who has a technique for looking at the future, and that is the peculiar function of artists. Artists are people who specialize in looking at the present. They're not much interested in the rearview mirror, the old familiar scenes and situations. One of the new developments in art in that regard, you see, is to regard pop art, is to regard the environment itself as an art form. Pop art simply tells you, avant-garde style, that the human environment is already an art form and has to be programmed as such. We do a good deal of thinking about jobs these days. Electronics replaces the job with the role, R-O-L-E. A surgeon doesn't have a job, he has a role. That is 60 jobs all at once. A mother doesn't have a job, she has a role. That is 60 or 80 jobs all at once. Under electronics, everybody has many things to do simultaneously, and that's a role. So role-playing and role-making is taking the place of the job. The job is a highly specialized, fragmented sort of activity, repetitive and fragmented, like the go-go girl. The job is on its way out. The role is on its way in. The role is involvement. The job is detachment.
The work of royalty was not preparing for any particular job in life, but simply growing up. Growing up meaning the use of all faculties, learning all things. And under electric conditions, this has become increasingly the destiny of ordinary individuals. Instead of specializing, using just a few of their faculties to acquire a particular skill, they have to use all their faculties and simply to know and to grow. This is therefore a far harder work than the old idea of job preparation, but far more exciting because far more satisfying to an integral being.
So that was a collection of quotes apparently from around 1966. Okay, let's go to the next one. This is apparently May 18, 1966. The first part is a speech. There's Atlantic City, New Jersey, May 18, 1966. And then some Tony segments. Okay, so let's start.
Like all great revolutions, the revolution in communication has its prophet. And he is Professor Herbert Marshall McLuhan, Director of the Center for Culture and Technology at the University of Toronto. Marshall McLuhan is concerned with man's total environment, and I think it would be fair to say that he considers communication to include all of the means by which we perceive and interpret the world around us. How we do so, in his view, determines what we see. Language, the alphabet itself, is a medium which limits the things which can be said in it or even thought in it. From this comes what is doubtless Marshall McLuhan's most famous pronouncement, that the medium is the message. He has developed and expounded this proposition in his two books, The Gutenberg Galaxy and Understanding Media, and they have made him much in demand and much discussed among people who preoccupy themselves with communication, from teachers to writers, from sociologists to advertising executives.
One of the things that puzzles many people about our world, about advertising, that there seems to be such a strange disproportion between the effect of the ad and the content. In modern advertising, there's much the same revolution going forward as has been going forward in, painting and poetry and in the world of entertainment, with the audience moving more and more into the act. Modern advertising is more and more a substitute for the product. Because of its rich resources and means of sensuous solicitation, modern advertising can give you the effect of almost anything without your having to bother about having the thing at all. Tony Schwartz is in the audience tonight, bless him, and he is an expert in this very department. In terms of auditory magic, the power of giving effect without thing is entirely within his domain. But, you see, the advertisers have been puzzled for a long time in their surveys to discover that people don't really read ads until they own the thing. And if you own that icebox or that car, then you notice the ads very much, because this is how you get your satisfaction. The ad world then becomes an enormous area of information service, part of the service industries, enabling you to substitute the effect for the thing, just like Picasso. The artists have been usually go through these maneuvers 50 or more years before the engineers get around to them. And so the advantage of knowing art is orientation in a complex world. There are some rather exciting things afoot. For example, if one wanted to talk about the future of work in our world, we know that it has very little to do with jobs as they're presently understood. It has much to do with discovery, much to do with knowing, much to do with involvement in processes, so much so that the future of work is plainly knowing. And there was a time when the job of royalty, the prince, was not to learn any special skill, but simply to grow up. Jacques Ellul, the author of Propaganda, points out that in our 20th century world, the child is the hardest working child in all human history. Our children, in a 20th century information environment, have to process more data than any human being in any previous culture of the world. Our children, from early infancy, are engaged in extraordinarily hard work. And that work is mainly just growing. growing up, because to grow up in a modern electronic environment is a fantastically complex and difficult job. It's also a job which threatens to deprive people of identity and, the personal concept. Because one of the peculiarities of an electronic environment is that people become so profoundly involved in each other that they lose that sense of private identity. This is one of the peculiar cruxes of our time, that people precisely become profoundly involved in one another in an all-at-once simultaneous field of happenings, and then begin to lose their sense of private identity, because identity used to be connected with simple classification and fragmentation and non-involvement. In a world of profound involvement, identity seems to evaporate. Well, the future of work as knowing, the future of identity as involvement, brings one around to a kind of idea of perhaps roles, instead of jobs, roles. A mother doesn't have a job, she has 60 jobs, and that's a role. A top exec doesn't have a job, he has many jobs simultaneously, that is a role. I think this is happening to all of us in varying degrees. The very speeded up world we live in guarantees that we can all have a highly integrated existence, which really points in the direction of role playing rather than of job holding. I was talking to a group of managers one time, and I thought I'd just try it out on them. It seemed to me plausible to suggest to them that the real future of old age in business is discovery. They were quite struck by this. It seemed to make profound sense. Most of them were over 40. But the point about old age as a period of discovery contradicts the merely chronological approach to things. But the older man in business is a man who knows the field. And he's in a much better position to be a discoverer than some younger man who is merely job-holding. The printed book created what we call the public. With the coming of electric circuitry, you have what is called the mass. It's a time factor. The book created the public because the book was, as a printed form, made possible a very large body of people, but not simultaneous. The peculiar dimension of the mass audience is that it's all at once. It's a happening. Like telegraph, like the daily paper. The daily paper is a good example of a happening because everything that's in it happens at the same moment. The dateline is the only organizing principle in a newspaper. There is no connection between the items otherwise than the dateline. And if you take away the dateline from any newspaper or whatever, you have a quite handsome surrealist poem. It becomes much more enjoyable if you pull the dateline off. The dateline presents a plausible pretext of rationality, meaning, connection, which is not really very deeply related to the newspaper. The sort of constellation of events that is incorporated on any page of a newspaper is a kind of environmental image for which many people find the natural to identify empathically and so on. And the paper as a happening is very much in this dimension of the all at once. The editorial page, by contrast, represents a point of view, a fixed, arrested position with regard to the happening. The newspaper, in regard to this, the editorial is very closely related to the book as a form. The book, the printed book, rather, as a form, created the public. And Montaigne said, upon recognizing the existence of this new entity, this new environment called the public, he said, I owe the La Publique a complete portrait of myself. It was a matter of immediate response on the part of writers that their task as writers would be from now on the etiolation, the evolving of self-portrait, an image. There was no such impulse or response in the Middle Ages when they had the scribe and manuscript culture, or in the ancient world. It was with the coming of the printed book that people suddenly felt the need to reflect, to bounce their image off this public as a form of self-expression. Self-portraiture. Self-portraiture was a very special response to the printed word and was never felt as a need or a response for the manuscript form of culture. Now, Xerox has brought a kind of revolution into the publishing world that is only being felt slowly. It will be felt more and more. Xerox is the application of electric circuitry to a world which had formerly been merely mechanical and fragmented. Xerox enables, or xerography enables, the reader to become publisher. And this is an important aspect of all electric circuitry. The audience is increasingly involved in the process. With the public, the audience was detached, observant, but not involved. With circuitry, the reader, the audience, becomes involved in itself and in the process of publishing. The book, the future of the book, is very much in the order of book as information service. Instead of the book as a fixed package of repeatable and uniform character suited to the market with pricing and so on, the book is increasingly taking on the character of service, an information service. And the book as an information service is tailor-made and custom-built.
You would walk a mile to make peace with somebody, you know, just like a uprising some way. He was always, if he got word, he would always go and make peace for everybody, get everybody pleased on both sides. People, at first, some of them would disagree, but in the end, he would win out. That's why I said if we had a president today, like Lincoln was, I don't think it would be all this excitement. I really don't.
I'm inclined to do what I do, perhaps because of environmental conditions in the past, influences that I've been subjected to. It's probably a combination of necessity and inclination. I was associated with the Indians from early childhood, and I took up music in a formal manner, in the classic tradition. And so I have the blending of the primitive and the very ultra-classical tradition. And I don't find the joining of the two to be incongruous at all.
I like to earn money, sort of. If anybody asks me to earn money, I accept it. Because I like to get more money.
Why?
When I'm very low on money and somebody asks me if I could, and somebody asks me to do a commercial, I really accept it because I like to get money. And I'm not so money crazy, but it's just the fun of doing a commercial that I like about it.
Jack and Jill went up the
hill
to fetch a pail of
water.
Jack fell down and broke
down.
And Jill came tumbling
after. Have a birthday day. Happy birthday to you. If you put a toy store up and you say, I want a puppy and a whistle and a horn and a hat and a dress and a ballerina costume, that's what you get. But when Santa Claus can't bring you, you can't cry. If the dog makes Willie a house, if you have to make him housebroken, if he makes a wee-wee in the apartment, you have to slap him with a newspaper. Then if he doesn't do it again, he's housebroken.
What do you think of the Russian sending the dog up in the satellite?
Well, I hope he doesn't get hurt. But if he does, I'm sure they'll send up a medical satellite.
In school, we each had to do a report on someplace, and I'm doing a report on Hawaii. This summer we're going camping, and for the whole month of July, this summer I'm going to go to Brownie Sleepaway Camp. It's all girls.
You'll mess my hair, and it's very special for tonight. It's just the way I want it. It's in a page boy with a high top, and that's the way I like it.
I'm taking guitar lessons, and that's fun. I take drama lessons after school, and that's great. And I've been working on the school newspaper. I might be editor next year. And I've been discovering boys.
Get some Bosco for Johnny's milk. It's delicious because it's Bosco.
Delicious.
That it is. Milk with Bosco.
Delicious.
Get some Bosco for Johnny's milk. It's delicious.
So that was the second recording of McClellan excerpts with some Tony Swartz signature recordings that he was known for, daily life stuff. Okay, so this one is a discussion with a student on the Tony Swartz radio program, January 16, 1968, WNYC in New York City.
Good morning. The other day I was discussing with my class the function of various newspapers and how we reacted to various newspapers, and the slogan of the New York Times came up, "All the news that's fit to print." And I asked one of the students what he thought that meant.
I believe that all the news that's fit to print is all the news that is important enough and worthy enough to let people know about it.
Well, it's interesting to see how an insightful professor, Dr. McLuhan, can really analyze that term. And let's make a sonomontage of the professor and the pupil, Dr. Marshall McLuhan, commenting about the New York Times slogan, and the student of mine, Miles Chapin, telling how he relates to the paper.
By the way, something occurs to me from the morning paper, an old cliche from the New York Times, all the news that's fit to print. Please meditate a little bit on that phrase. It's full of ambiguities. It's a real lulu. But the New York Times prints all news in a form that suits the printed page. It doesn't print news, doesn't matter what the news is, it doesn't print news in an auditory way. Headlines scream. They're not visual, they're auditory.
In the daily news, they will cover more the stories, the murders, or the, a subway grating falling in, or a crash of the trains. They would cover that as, you know, hot material, first page.
The New York Times doesn't print auditory news, only printed news. It translates all news into a printed form. That's what it means, fit to print. All the news that will fit the printed word. Or we print all news in the form of print, not in the form of hearing or feeling.
Things you'll find on the first page of the New York Times, you'll find on maybe the eighth or ninth pages, which are of the daily news, whereas in the New York Times, it'll be on the top of the front page with a lengthy report on it.
In other words, it's a literary newspaper, and all the news appears in editorial form.
I read the Daily News, but I know that the Times is a better paper. I read the Daily News because I'd like to read maybe the comics or the funny articles they have, the $5 for embarrassing moments, and the Your Family Doctor. When I want to read news and when I want to know what's going on in the world, I read the New York Times. But when I want to read a paper, and, you know, like in the morning, I don't want to be confronted with Britain devaluating the pound. I want to be sort of confronted by Kenny Robbins cheating on the honor system in Dondi or something like that. It's I avidly follow all the comics in the Daily News, and I sort of wish the New York Times had comics.
Another feature that is incompatible with this print form that the Times uses is the comic strip. They can't have comics. Comics are not fit to print because they don't belong to the printed form. Comics are tactile, sculptured icons.
It's an interesting world when you look into it. That was Professor Marshall McLuhan and a student from my Tuesday morning class. See you soon.
Means by all the news that's been.
It simply means that it's news, it's not, quote, dirty, unquote.
Okay, what do you think?
I believe that all the news that's fit to print is all the news that is important enough and worthy enough to let people know about it, and news that could have an effect on people, that could touch people, and that people could understand, and not things like Sally Jacobs lost her cat up a tree. I mean, who wants to know that? But people do want to know what's going on in Vietnam and that Britain devaluated the pound, and that will have an effect on their lives.
All right, what do you think they mean?
Yeah, I don't think it's how much news you can stuff in 38 sheets of a newspaper. It's news that's fit to print and fit to be called news, kind of not just Sally got her cat lost in a tree. It's stuff that people want to hear about.
All right. What do you think of that?
I'd just be copying Marshall's statements because I recall them so well.
All right. What do you think they meant before you heard his statement?
I really thought it meant all the news or events that's fit for the public eye so that it could be publicly proclaimed in sense of decent, really. That's what I thought it meant.
No, it was the same thing I said.
Well, you say decent, he says important.
My reaction to this over the years was thinking that it meant all the news that's important at first. And then when I got involved in things that I could witness and then would read about, for instance, if I was in Times Square on New Year's Eve and I'd make a count of the people and then read about it in the paper, I'd see a difference there. Or if I was at Madison Square Garden at a political rally, and it was of a different party than the Times, I'd notice a difference in count. And I used to come away with, I used to say many times, because of my observing differences in things that I saw in the news and things that I saw in the Times, I mean, things that I saw happen in life and then read about them in the Times, I used to come away and say, all the news that fits our print, you see, and all the news, well, they say all the news that's fit to print, but I used to play around with it, all the news that fits our print and so forth. Now,
I would think that applying the medium is the message to all the news that fits in print, changing it a little bit, like you cannot get the feeling of something like in a human interest story, or if they're covering, say, riots, like the summer in Detroit, they cannot really get put in print the feeling that sort of hung in the air, or like at a rally of a labor union.
One second, I better.
Well, if you read a newspaper story about something that is really moving or touching, you can't really get the feeling. It's like if you have a dream one night and the dream is of a story, a really funny story, and that thing sticks in your mind all day, and you try to write it out on paper, you just cannot capture the feeling that you first had for it. Like, I know this is true with a friend of mine, an adult in the school I go to, did this. He had a story like that.
Well, let me finish.
All right, sure.
Well, newspaper, wait, Weston, what do you want me to say exactly, really?
About the positive business.
No, in the newspaper, the only positive part of the news is the first page of the second section of the Times. The rest of it's just negative and saying how terrible the world is and all the problems, and I don't want to know about the problem. If there's a problem, I can get involved and try to help to correct, fine and dandy, and I'll do all I can to do it. But, you know, war in Vietnam, what can I do about that? Nothing. I just see how pathetic it is. It just hurts to read.
All right. What were you saying about the Daily News and the type of thing they cover?
Oh, well, in the Daily News, they will cover more the stories, the murders, or a subway grating falling in, or a crash of the trains. They would cover that as hot material, first page, whether it's the New York Times. You wouldn't really find it at all. Like, I look a lot, and things you'll find on the first page of the New York Times, you'll find on maybe the 8th or 9th pages, which are of the Daily News, which are three-quarters ads, and then there's a little skinny little column over on the side, which is news, and you'll find it there, not covered very well, whereas in the New York Times, it'll be in bold-faced print on the top of the front page with a lengthy report on it. And it appeals more to the reader of the New York Times than it does to the reader of the Daily News.
Does advertising have good or bad news?
Advertising? What do you mean, like, there's a sale at E.J. Corvette? Oh, well, that's good news, mostly. And there, I must say, the Daily News is mostly advertisements. And so it does convey sort of good news, whereas the first section of the New York Times conveys bad news if you're going to lump it into a big thing. I read the Daily News, but I know that the Times is a better paper. I read the Daily News because I like to read maybe the comics or the funny articles they have, the $5 for embarrassing moments, which I've sent in about 20. I've never had one done. And your family doctor in the inquiring photographer I like. And I like the one that's written by the guy who used to be in all the Abbott and Costello movies. There's a column written by him, which is always on some one person, and it's always a human interest. Like, on one time, it was about a blind bowler, and on one time, it was about the world champion archer, and it's been about head of film departments at universities and things like that.
So how do the two papers affect you differently?
Oh, well, I read the New York Times. When I want to read news and when I want to know what's going on in the world, I read the New York Times. But when I want to read a paper and, you know, like in the morning, I don't want to be confronted with Zap Britain devaluating the pound. I want to be sort of confronted by Kenny Robbins cheating on the honor system in Dondi or something like that. It's, I avidly follow all the comics in the Daily News, and I sort of wish the New York Times had comics. They'd have more sophisticated comics, probably. They'd have things like Rex Morgan, M.D., which I don't read, incidentally.
Yeah. That's the end of that one. January 16th, 1968. You can see the kids talking about Vietnam. It's just starting to hit people. It was that month, January 68, when the Tet Offensive started, and Americans found out that the war wasn't going their way. So these kids are reflecting that month.